It's that time again. Yeah. Ya la hora. You know, power hour. Ponle atención, class is in session. Tune in for an hour, maybe more, that's a blessing. Learn from the captains and the leadership. Flee from religion, cause some churches never teaching shit. Everything you learn for your benefit. Line upon line is a requisite. Never take a deficit, yeah. That means you take a loss if you stray from the way. You get the understanding if you study every day. Apply what you learn and bless when you pray. It's one interpretation, man, it say what it say. Ya viene el tiempo, entra para el templo, aprende del maestro con talento, la Biblia es el centro, usando a Israel como instrumento, no te pierdas en doctrina como viento, estudia y ora y aplica, tiempo para Dios, ven, hace una cita, escritura dinamita, morenos y hispanos y israelita, oye cómo explica, Israel unido en Cristo para la vida, nunca se divida. Tune in, it's the power hour, learn your family history, don't be a coward, yeah. Tune in, it's the power hour. I said learn your family history, don't be a coward.
Yeah, history is the word, it's the power hour. The 11th hour. Tune in to your history, know it in your history. Power hour, the 11th hour. You don't want your true history, 11th hour. Power Hour.
Shalom, shalom. Welcome to the Power Hour Plus Edition. I am Captain Yashua, Officer Shia,
Soldier Eric,
Soldier Tobias.
Shalom, shalom to the 12 tribes, shalom. All listening in. All right. I sound a little staticky. Test, test, test. It's a little better. Now I sound real faded. Normally I hear myself clearer. You still messing with the levels? Check, check, check.
Yes, sir. I'm just evening you out.
Okay. Please do, because it's bothering my ears. All right. Let me see. Now it's getting there. No, now I sound muffled again. Oh. Check, check, check.
How's that?
Let me see. Does that sound good? Power hour. Checking, check, check. I think, okay, that's better. I'll deal with it, I guess. We should have had that going.
Yes.
Hey, so we are back. We had a little hiatus from the show, all right? I feel like it was it only 1 week? I feel like it was more than that.
Two.
It was two. Why did we miss the previous week? Was
no
I not
moon.
Well?
No moon.
Oh, and then we had the other. Okay, so that's what it was. All right.
No
I was like,
moon,
was that sick
and then, like,
again?
Hainer,
I don't remember.
Him.
Right. That I remember. That right. I remember. Well, we are back. We are back. And I'm very excited to do this show today. I've been going over our series on Boys to Men and how, you know, black, Latino, Native, Indigenous men need kind of those father figures, those people to grow us up into proper men, not just physically mature, but all the responsibilities that come with it. We will continue that series, Lord's will, okay? We will continue that series, Lord's will. But it's going to be next week because we have a very special guest tonight. Those of you who have followed the show before, you remember, it was about over a year ago.
A little
we
over
had Dr.
Year.
Sanchez, the founder of the Brown Berets.
That's right.
We had a really great interview with him. And in that synergy and speaking about the Panthers, the Brown Berets, we often mention the Young Lords.
Yes, we
and
do.
A lot of people don't know who the Young Lords are. I'm a little partial to the Young Lords.
I was going
to
say, you didn't know who the Young Lords were.
I didn't as a kid.
And,
no.
And you were born in New York.
So. I was born and raised in the Bronx, so. But being so-called Puerto Rican, all right, that was the essence of the Young Lords group. So I'm not going to give too much away because I really want to hear it from the source of our guest tonight, who is much more well versed in this type of research. We have esteemed Baruch professor, Dr. Joanna Fernandez, joining us. And I have a little write-up here. Do we have the picture of the book, The Young Lords, A Radical History? that we can show the audience. Joanna Fernandez, all right, she has her PhD. She's an associate professor in Baruch's Department of History. She recently won a slew of awards for her latest book, The Young Lords, A Radical History. I'm reading this off the Baruch News Center site. At their annual meeting in mid-April, this is from 2021, I believe, the Organization of American Historians announced that Dr. Fernandez was the recipient of three of their top book prizes, including the highly prestigious Frederick Jackson Turner Award, which is given to the author of a first scholarly book dealing with some aspect of U.S. history. Because make no mistake about it, groups like the Young Lords, the Brown Berets, that's history. That's not stuff that is necessarily taught in your typical school programs, but it is important history to understand kind of the journey of our people in this country. So her book traces the history of the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican counterpart of the Black Panther Party. She also received the, I don't know if I'm going to say this right, Merle Curdy Social History Award and the Liberty Legacy Foundation Award, all right?
Brother, zoom that in. Brothers, let's zoom that in, all right?
So, I'm not going to keep going on and on. I know you zoomed it in. Go up to the book so they can see the title of the book. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome you, Dr. Fernandez, to the show. We thank you for joining us tonight. Welcome.
Thank you for a wonderful introduction.
Credit where credit is due in doing some research on you and reading this background. We're very excited to have you here and have a source that's done research because, you know, a lot of times we live in an era of where kind of everybody has a platform because of social media. It's so easy for information to flow so freely, and you don't necessarily know if it's the correct information that's flowing out. So to have someone with your credentials who's done the research and I would imagine what's a labor of love to put a piece like this together, it's for me, going to a stronger, more reliable source in getting some of this history and some of this information out, especially to the newer generation. You know, I'm in my 40s. The Young Lords, I think, so I was born in 77. Their activism kind of died down a little bit from what I understand around then. So I had a familiarity with them as I got older and started kind of looking at the various struggles and things that we deal with as Latinos. And knowing that there were groups out there that also fought during those civil rights movements. But I don't think a lot of the current generation does understand that. And, you know, as we have some of the questions and we'll see where the dialogue goes, clearly we can discuss that more. But to me, this is some important history. I think it's something that the media doesn't really cover as much, especially when it comes to Latinos, the different things and the different plights that we've dealt with and how we were also part of the afflictions that were going on during the civil rights era and even today in many respects. So again, thank you for being here. I don't know if you have any opening comments you'd like to say. We have I don't want to say a ton of questions. I don't want to scare you off.
You mentioned that it was a labor of love, and that's exactly what it was. I started writing about the Young Lords in the 1980s at Columbia University. And
I'm sorry, doctor. I don't know. Is that us? It's a little choppy, the connection, doctor. I don't want us to miss anything you're saying. I heard you started writing in the 19 and then it kind of trailed off a little bit. Is that our end, the connection? All right. We have the producer checking our end to make sure.
I have all bars.
Yeah, so maybe it's Aaron. He's just going to double check. I just don't want us to miss anything that you're saying. And I'm glad you're going into this because my first question was going into what inspired you to write this book. So we're already kind of flowing the way we need to flow. So just give us a moment so we can check this.
Right.
And I apologize for the technical difficulties.
No problem. Would it help if I had an earpiece?
No, I hear you clearly. It feels like it's some distortion, you know, like when you're on a cell phone and it just kind of breaks up. Right now you sound great, so I'm not sure. I just want to confirm with the production team that they're okay so we don't miss anything that you're going to say. Yeah, we're good? Okay. All right. So we were talking about it being a labor of love. You started to say when you started researching for this book. Please go right ahead, Doctor.
Right. So I started doing the research and writing about the Young Lords when I was a graduate student at Columbia University in the 1990s. And nobody knew anything about the Young Lords. They're kind of sexy right now, mm-hmm. within a layer of the academy, and folks are beginning to find out about the Young Lords. But when I decided to write my doctoral dissertation on the Young Lords, my professors knew nothing about this, and they looked at me like I had three heads. The Young who? So it wasn't easy, and it took decades, really, to bring together an arsenal of research to write this incredible history. Mm-hmm. And I felt that I bring on so that a book would be embraced by the history profession and by the academy. And I think I succeeded. I never in my life imagined that I would get the Frederick Jackson Turner Award. That was not part of my, and when I was told that, I remember I was in the Dominican Republic driving to the capital from the northeast of the island, and I opened an email while I was driving, and I had to stop because I was like, wait, what? This is like Mr. White Man Award. With Mr. White Man Historian Award.
I'm glad you said it because I was going to say it a little nicer than you, but I'm grateful you're being so frank. You know, this is the type of award that I would imagine many of our type of people, you know, would. It's not something that's synonymous with us. This is, again, something that, you know, in academia where we're underrepresented in a lot of areas, but academia is one of them. And for you to have an award for something that deals with such a radical group and what right. they stood for, obviously in the world of the white man and the white in academia, it's definitely somewhat surprising in that regard. But also, like you said, I mean, you're talking about from the 90s you started doing all this research. I mean, that's incredible. It's almost 30 years in the making then.
Yeah, I interviewed approximately 100 people for the book.
Wow.
And I scoured the archival libraries. I think I found everything there was to be found about the Young Lords. And I took my time. You know, I decided that this was going to happen on my timeline, not on the Academy's timeline for tenure. So I blew all the deadlines within the Academy because I wanted to write this for, not just for the Academy, but I wanted to write it for an emerging generation.
I think we have you frozen a little bit. I don't know if you can hear us.
I can hear you perfectly.
Okay. Yeah. They're checking again. I'm not sure if we're having some issues with the internet. You froze.
Well, maybe should I eliminate my image, because sometimes that helps.
Let's try that for a little bit and let's see if that works. I do like the fact that we can see you though for the engagement part, but if we can't hear you, it doesn't matter if we can see you. So let's try that and see how that works, and then we'll go from there. So you mentioned you did this on your time and your way. Can you go into a little bit about your inspiration, your driving motivation, to kind of not just put this book together, but to do the type of work you do and to educate on the topics that you do? You mentioned to an emerging generation. I'm 100% on board with you with that. I don't want to beat down on our generation, but the reality is it's what it is. And I think there's a loss of an appreciation for, not that everything's perfect where we're at now, but kind of the people that came before us to get us where we're at today. What was your inspiration? What was your motivation to put this book together and to do the kind of activism and work that you do?
Well, I learned about the Young Lords in college. I grew up in the Bronx in the 1980s and 90s. And it took me getting to an elite university to find out about the Young Lords.
Yeah.
And I was shocked that this was not something that came across my desk in the Bronx, where the Young Lords were active, and at Lincoln Hospital, where, in fact, my father almost died in 1970.
Oh, and actually, I believe I was born in Lincoln Hospital. I'm from the Bronx as well. I'm a lifelong Bronx native. I'm here in Phoenix, Arizona now for the past 5 years, but I lived all my life in the Bronx as well. And I believe I was born in Lincoln Hospital. So,
the Young Lords occupied Lincoln Hospital to call attention to the horrific conditions under which Black Americans and Puerto Ricans were getting medical care.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this was where I grew up. So I was just beside myself, and I decided to go to graduate school rather than law school, not really knowing what that entailed. And if you're going to get a PhD, you have to write a doctoral dissertation that's based on original research. And I decided to write my dissertation on the organization because the Young Lords is one of the most successful and effective organizations of the 1960s, of what is known as the New Left, of which the Young Lords and the Black Panthers are a part. These were the people who transformed our understanding of race in the United States, the relationship of people of color to white people. These were the people who fought against the Vietnam War, who changed our understanding of gender oppression. These were the people who changed America in the 60s, and the Young Lords were one of the most successful groups within that umbrella known as the New Left, and nobody knows about them.
Yes, yes, I know, and it's one of those things where, I mean, part of me feels this is largely by design. I think there's a larger agenda to create disunity amongst Blacks and Latinos. I know moving out west, I've seen a divide in it wasn't like that in New York. I think Blacks and Hispanics kind of growing up in the same neighborhoods and everything. I try to share that with a lot of people out this way in the West. We grew up in the same projects. We grew up in the same tenements and things like that. So it wasn't some strange thing. And out here in the West, there's a little more of a divide in that. But I think when you start to see that our oppression and our struggles were very much the same, I think that's important information to bring to light nowadays. And I think the media, by and large, kind of throws that under the table. You know, they'll highlight what they do and what they can, I guess, in terms of dealing with so-called Blacks. But you don't see a lot of that stuff come to light when it comes to Latinos. And I say that because the Black Panthers are famous, you know, and you see a lot of works on that. And what was the movie just recently? What was it?
Black Messiah.
The Black Messiah.
Judas
and the Black Messiah. And, you know, they had like a little snippet there where they spoke about the Young Lords. And, you know, I had an awareness of it. I'm like, gosh, see, that's like the most kind of attention that like the Young Lords would get in that regard. Mm-hmm. And then nobody really knows what was behind that. You know, you'll often hear that they were like the Puerto Rican counterpart of the Black Panther Party. But what does that really mean? You know, you know, hopefully you can shed some light to our audience today on that as we continue on with the interview to talk about those type of things. So I appreciate your emphasis on showing how it's almost like a hidden history. I'm sure like a lot of our audience might be familiar with the name because we've spoken about them on the show somewhat. But there's not a lot of literature on them. You know, you'll see maybe a wiki article. You might see an obscure news article on the web where they speak about a history of it. But you don't really see too much about it. I will say I purchased your book when I knew we were doing this interview in Kindle format. I've not got to read it yet. I was hoping to read it before the show so I can speak more to excerpts from the book. I have not done that. But I'm very much looking forward to it. And then, you know, kind of maybe do a deeper dive, you know, after the fact on the show and then having your insight in it. So so one of the things I gather is your motivation was that this hidden history piece of it, kind of bringing it out. Were there any other factors that I mean, because for 30 years to research this and, like you said, to make this your thing, like there had to be some drive, I mean, that said, hey, I need to bring this to light. People need to know about this.
itself was shot. The person who's highlighted in the film you referenced, can you hear me?
Yes, yes. We lost you for a second, but I think it's just going to be kind of what it'd be. With...
Well, maybe I should do this.
Yeah, it was a little better that way, yeah.
So the person very briefly highlighted in the Black Messiah film about Fred Hampton is Chacha Jimenez.
Yes, correct. Yep.
Chacha Jimenez was a gang leader of a gang called the Young Lords that formed in 1959. He was caught up in recidivism, in and out of prison as a teenager. And in 1968, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, he happened to be in a Chicago prison and was radicalized by the moment he started reading. And when he left prison, he decided to transform the Young Lords, the gang, into a political organization. And while in prison, he would hear on the radio reports on the Black Panther Party. And since the Black Panthers fought the police, he felt that that's something that the gang would understand. And so he set out to learn about the Black Panthers. He met Fred Hampton, and the leader of the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party. And Fred Hampton's meeting Chacha Jimenez was the linchpin of his Rainbow Coalition, a coalition that included Puerto Ricans and Mexicans in the Young Lords, Black Americans in the Black Panther Party, and poor whites from Appalachia who had migrated to Chicago and were in a group called the White Patriots. And this was a coalition, the Rainbow Coalition, across the basis of shared Congress. So the story I tell in chapter one, it is a Herculean effort to transform a gang into a political organization. That is precisely what happens in Chicago. Chacha leads that effort. Fred Hampton and other Black Panthers are involved in the process. But it ultimately takes the killing of a young lord by a cop, undercover cop, to really politicize and transform the rest of the members of the Young Lords. So that is an epic battle that I thought was worth telling. Few people know about that story. Chacha Jimenez told me in numerous interviews I conducted with him that they were involved in desegregating beaches and playgrounds in Chicago. They were not part of the civil rights movement, but in Chicago, Puerto Ricans were persecuted by white gangs. And at some point, Puerto Rican and Mexican youth decided that they were going to stand their ground and fight for their turf and literally desegregate the beach and the playground. These are incredible stories that you don't think about when you think about the civil rights movement.
So you mentioned that, you know, the Black Panthers kind of helped support based on Chacha's studies and him being aware of it. To what extent do you know or did you find in your research, what type of support were they giving? Because obviously the Black Panthers were structured, organized. They were able to move so-called minorities in a way that seemed intimidating, definitely to white America, but when you're trying to make aggressive moves, sometimes you have to maintain that type of aggressive posture to transform the minds of the people, right? There's a form of rigidity. There's a form of discipline that needs to be there in order to move as one unit. I see the Black Panthers as kind of excelling at that at the time that they were there. What specifically did they kind of bring to the table in helping Chacha and kind of advising him on bringing and converting the gang, like you said?
Well, I think it's important to consider that what the Black Panther Party did was that it established a model of organization for others to follow. Mm. You can't underestimate how significant that is. They had a model that worked in integrating people who were not political and putting them through a series of political education workshops and transforming them very quickly. So that was the model that the Young Lords adopted. One of the things that Cha-Cha did was that he was interviewed by the Black Panther Party newspaper about his trajectory, and that interview was published, right? And Puerto Rican kids in New York read about Cha-Cha in New York. So, and when they heard about Cha-Cha, these Puerto Rican kids who were reading the Black Panther newspaper, they decided to immediately go to Chicago to meet him. Hmm. Cha-Cha also was sent to Oakland to be trained by the Black Panther Party leadership and headquarters, which was situated there. And it wasn't only the Black Panthers who helped train Cha-Cha and other Young Lords. There were other socialists who understood the significance of this experiment of turning street people into a fighting revolutionary unit. There's a group called LADO, the Latin American Defense Organization, that formed in Chicago after the Puerto Rican riots in that city in 1966. So LADO, as soon as, you know, they heard that the Young Lords were being politicized, that the Black Panthers were involved, they went up to Lincoln Park, where the Young Lords were organizing, and began to help them publish their newspaper, which they called Pitirre, which is a little bird in Puerto Rico. And it was later called the YLO. So the training came from different sectors, but the most important thing was the structure of organization that the Young Lords adapted from the Black Panthers. If you think about it, you need that because it takes years for folks and activists to figure out what kind of organization they want to create and what it's going to look like, what its leadership structure is going to be. And the Young Lords didn't have to, they didn't have to figure that out from scratch. They just adapted what was out there and what was working from the Black Panthers. And of course, it wasn't a replica. There were, you know, there was a different culture and there were differences. But ultimately, the Young Lords, like the Black Panthers, considered themselves socialists. They believed that class oppression was tied to racial oppression. And they wanted to organize in the community. So the Young Lords in Chicago started doing breakfast programs like the Black Panthers. They established these health clinics. And the one in Chicago was very, very successful. And there was a willingness among other activists to join in and help the effort.
And that's amazing that you say that, because as you're speaking about the, how critical it is to have that organizational structure and so on, and how that's something really that, you know, in the research we've done in covering various topics on this show, that's one thing that always stands out. I mentioned at the beginning during your introduction, I believe it was about a year ago, we actually interviewed Dr. David Sanchez, the founder of the Brown Berets, which is sometimes referred to as like the Mexican version of the Black Panther Party. And I get where that comes from, because again, the Black Panther Party is known. They're famous, right? It's something that's very easy to pick up in the media. Almost anybody, even if you're not black, knows the Black Panthers, right? But not so much the Brown Berets, not so much the Young Lords. Sure. And he also mirrored a lot of what you're saying as this as well. And that was a big takeaway we took from him.
Right.
And he spoke about, he used the term exchange of talents is what kind of happened between the different organizations. And he said, you know, listen, they would send guys to us, we would send guys to them. And, you know, that's what kind of helped us really kind of make a mark in the communities that they were serving.
Right. Dr. David Sanchez had mentioned they had the, he had the coffee shop that they opened, right, with their own money, and how he had a lot of the guests from Black Panthers come. And he had said that also a lot of brothers from the Young Lords had came and were amongst the Brown Berets. So there was a lot of intermingling, helping one another.
In your research, did you see a lot of that as well, as far as the Brown Berets and their involvement, like all these groups together?
Absolutely. So the Young Lords covered the struggles of the Brown Berets, Chicanos in the West Coast, in their newspaper. And in Chicago, the Young Lords was composed of Puerto Ricans and Mexicans. So there was a tremendous amount of solidarity. When I interviewed the folks in Chicago, the Young Lords, they mentioned that the Black Panthers didn't think that they were better than the Young Lords. They worked together toward a similar end. And there was a tremendous sense of solidarity. There was optimism about the future. People really believed that revolution was, you know, not far away, and that people of color and white Americans who were progressive needed to come together and take the reins of history in their hands.
Let me ask you, being that this is something that, I guess, I'm going to ask this, this is a two-part question. We know that you say, you know, you discovered that many people did not know about them. I like yourself, you said you didn't learn about them till, you know, you went into college. And I didn't learn about them till I started researching, you know, different activism and really trying to look at examples in history to kind of see our faces. Like I said, you know, I grew up, you know, in the South Bronx, Puerto Rican upbringing. And, you know, I didn't see a lot of that. You don't see a lot of that activism. Do you think that was by design? Do you think, like, what's your, in your research or in your opinion, why is it that it's something that's so obscure that, you know, you have to go to universities or have to stumble across it somehow?
Well, think about the conversation that's being had today in American society around critical race theory.
Mm-hmm.
The country is having a nervous breakdown over teaching people the history of racism in America.
Yep.
So, boom. It's not something that started today. It's a strategy of colonial domination.
Mm.
If you are going to dominate a people, you have to strip them of a sense that they have a history and a culture, because that helps people come together and have a sense of their common goals, their common past, their common oppression. And it's the basis for a struggle against oppression. So it's one of the many strategies of colonial domination. One of them is that, strip people of their history and culture. The other one is strip people of the land. Another one is demonize the people you're going to oppress.
Oh, yes, yes. We've gone over that quite a bit on the show, and the demonization part for sure, and the stripping of that identity and what they represent. So we certainly can relate to understanding that here on this show as you bring that out.
Definitely.
So, yeah. So, you know, by design, sure. I mean, the textbooks of high schools are written literally in Texas. Texas has a monopoly on what goes into textbooks that are used across the country in middle school and high schools. Need I say more?
No, and I mean, and that speaks volumes. I mean, I think in Texas, I don't know if it passed. They were pushing hard for legislation where you would not teach the slave trade anymore in school.
Correct. Critical race theory.
Well, she mentioned that about the critical race theory. But even before they started with the critical race theory as the title for it, it started with simply removing it from 16, the textbooks 19, at all.
Like the 1619 project.
Yeah,
exactly.
And them being so diabolically opposed to it, you know. And so with that being said, and we know that it was by design, this is the second part to my question. What, if any, challenges or external forces or factors did you face in bringing the book to light and getting it published?
I didn't, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
My professors at Columbia, where I wrote the dissertation, encouraged me to write the history, but they didn't know the history themselves. There was no literature.
Mm-hmm.
So if I encountered obstacles, it was finding sources. But I turned myself into Inspector Gadget, and I found everything there was to be found on the Young Lords. It was not easy for me to get a job, because as a professor, you have to write a letter to apply for a job that's advertised. And in that letter, you have to write about what you're writing about. Mm. And no one knows who the Young Lords are.
Right. So then they're like, what is she talking about?
So what is this craziness about?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I had to figure out how to make the Young Lords, how to talk about the Young Lords in a way that would make sense to the people who were reading my application.
Hmm.
So most people don't know that the first known patient bill of rights was drafted by the Young Lords at Lincoln Hospital in collaboration with workers in the hospital and doctors. The first patient bill of rights.
Wow.
Something that we take for granted today. The Young Lords are credited with the passage of anti-lead poisoning legislation in New York, because they occupied the office of the health department, because lead poisoning among children was a disaster on wheels. There were lead belts in the city, in East Harlem, the Brooklyn and the South Bronx. That is neighborhoods where children, Black American and Puerto Rican children, were dying because they were eating chipped paint from the walls of these tenement buildings. And so the Young Lords, you know, went to town. They occupied, they went door to door, tested people for lead poisoning and children, and discovered that something like 30% of the children they tested were lead poisoned. And lead poisoning is a neurotoxin.
Mm-hmm.
Lead is a neurotoxin that you can't reverse. That brain damage. And so all the ruckus they created around this issue finally led the city to pass legislation. And I found out about this by going to the Municipal Archive of the City of New York, which is one of the major libraries that collects information about the city. I literally just went to a folder called lead poisoning. And in that folder, I found, this is before Google, I found an article published by the Journal of Public Health in which it credits the Young Lords for the passage of this legislation.
Wow. Wow, that's something. And you have that in the book, right? Because I may use that in a future show once I read the book.
Right. It's in the book. It's okay. In the book. And then I went to the papers of the mayor's office, the John Lindsay papers, and I found the Young Lords there, because the mayor's men were meeting with the young lords to get them to get the young lords to abandon a church that they occupied and the hospital and a whole bunch of other interactions they had with the young lords, including mimicking their work and trying to essentially co-opt the radicalism and activism of the young lords.
So, you know, everything that you're saying as our audience listens, as we hear this, it doesn't sound like it was a bad thing, right? Radical has such a negative connotation in its definition. But when you look up the definition of it, it's really just going into advocating, obviously, quite strongly, quite passionately for complete change, right? And I guess what makes it radical is that you're trying to upset the status quo in how you do it. But you hear radical and like in the media and everything, it's part of that demonization, I think, when you say radical.
Exactly.
You know, some of the synonyms for radical are revolutionary, progressive, reforming. And those things are scary to the establishment because it upends what they've been trying to conceal all these years. Part of the history.
So I use that word deliberately in the title of the book. The book is called The Young Lords, A Radical History.
Yes.
And radical essentially means grasping at the roots and root causes.
Mm.
People who are radical historically have wanted to identify the root causes of social problems. Those are the good guys, not the bad guys.
Yeah.
But it upsets the apple cart, as you said, and no system wants to be challenged. And radicals argue that if the cause is deeply rooted, you need to uproot it.
Yep.
You need to transform society if you are seriously committed to improving society and undoing the wrong.
Absolutely. And knowing that that's the case and the negative connotation that that has, it's known that the U.S. government has throughout history taken a very aggressive approach in terms of minority groups uniting their activism. We know that the Young Lords were targeted by the FBI's COINTELPRO program. Why do you think this is the case in general, and why specifically with the Young Lords? Because, again, it doesn't sound like anything that would seem – you know, things like Patient Bill of Rights, so on and so forth. It wasn't like a group trying to necessarily, quote-unquote, overthrow the government.
Right,
overthrow. Obviously, we know how the media and the establishment will try to portray those things. In your research, did you find a lot of that? Why do you think they were specifically targeted by that COINTELPRO?
I think it's important to say that the Young Lords, like the Black Panthers, were self-proclaimed revolutionaries.
Right.
They believed that capitalism is a system organized around profit and its pursuit that ignores human need, and that's a bad thing.
Mm.
So they were socialists, self-proclaimed socialists. They believed that slavery and capitalism grew up simultaneously and produced white supremacy and the exploitation and oppression of working class people. And you were not going to end white supremacy without ending the system upon which it was built. However, they were not alone. In 1969, 2 million students polled said that they believed in the importance of building a revolutionary party in the United States, right? In the United States. So 1968, 1969, these are years of radical imagination, of radical hopes, of revolutionary hopes. Martin Luther King, if you read what Martin Luther King is writing, the speech that he's giving in 1967, you would say that he sounds like Malcolm X.
Mm. Yeah, and you know what? And that's another topic we've discussed in our organization as well, is you find out later on, I guess that Dr. King was kind of seeing the writing on the wall for what it was. And there's that speech that he gives years later.
Right. Towards the end of his life
where he's speaking about he feels he's integrated his people into a burning house.
Correct.
Right.
So you can kind of see the shift in motivations in what he was realizing as all this information came to light.
Yet those writings are hidden.
Yeah, they always speak of the I have a dream, and they'll kind of let that prosper. But they don't speak about what you're talking about, where, you know, Malcolm X was obviously extremely demonized.
Correct.
And though they may have had various different methods in how they went about things, it was all the same cause. Like, it's you said something that may seem pretty obvious, but I guess in you saying it, it kind of, you know, that era of the 60s, the civil rights era, I mean, it was profound.
So the Young Lords and the Black Panthers were not out of character.
Right, right. It was right in line.
They were in sync with what most Americans agreed with.
Mm-hmm.
Most Americans at that moment agreed that there was something profoundly wrong with the country. Mm-hmm. Most Americans agreed that we had no business fighting a colonial war in Vietnam and killing the Vietnamese. And Americans, both Black Americans, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, but also I said white Americans, they were fighting against the war. So you know what I tell my students and what I say when I'm giving a talk is that you have to consider that after World War II, emerges in the world the era of wars and revolutions against European colonial rule in Asia and Africa and U.S. colonial rule in Latin America, right? There's the Cuban Revolution. There's the revolution in Algeria. The maps of Africa, the map of Africa is transformed by these wars of revolution for independence, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
The colonized nations are fighting for independence. So revolution was in the air. And if you were asked, who are you going to stand with? Do you stand with the slave master or with the slave?
Mm-hmm.
Most Americans were going to tell you, oh, no, I stand with the slave. Do you stand with the colonizer or do you stand with the colonized? Mm-hmm. Oh, we stand with the colonized. Because these movements and these revolutions established a new value in society, and that's to fight against oppression. But of course, this was a threat to American political rule in the world.
Mm.
So at the moment when the Vietnamese are kicking American butt in Vietnam, it was very dangerous for the Young Lords and the Black Panthers to essentially establish communication with the Vietnamese and say, yeah, we agree with your defiance and with your battle against the American colonial military industrial powerhouse that's devastating your country. This was also the height of the Cold War, right? The fight against so-called communism. So there was a lot of surveillance, not just against the Young Lords and the Black Panthers, but Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. The white organizations were also surveilled, but the American government and COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI, reserved special anger and vitriol for the Black Panthers in particular. And they launched a homicidal campaign against the Black Panthers that the Young Lords didn't experience, for example. However, the Young Lords were surveilled Chacha Jimenez was followed and arrested numerous times in Chicago. He had to go underground because the cops were on him. And what the FBI did, especially in New York, because the organization spread from Chicago to New York eventually, was that they were able to break bonds of trust among people who loved each other. Think about it. That's the best way to break an organization. If you begin to distrust your sister and your brother.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the, you know, some people may not be aware, the COINTELPRO program, they would infiltrate these organizations, meaning planting people in there to cause that type of distrust, to cause mm-hmm. that disunion. They would attempt to discredit key figures and try to really disrupt these movements. You know, many of our audience may not be fully aware of that. And it's telling how impactful it would be that they would, that the Young Lords would even get this type of attention. Because like you said, obviously the emphasis that it had on the Panthers was extreme. You said homicidal even, I believe. Mm-hmm. And maybe it wasn't as extreme for the Young Lords, but they still felt that they were significant enough in what they were doing to infiltrate and discredit, to create that distrust and that disloyalty amongst each other.
Absolutely. I requested papers, the FBI papers, the federal papers on the Young Lords, and there are thousands of pages of surveillance of the Young Lords. And I also sued the NYPD, the New York Police Department, for its failure to release to me its papers, which were due to any citizen who requested them under the FOIL law, the Freedom of Information law.
Wow. And this was recent. Like, this isn't, it's not like they tried to hide this in the 60s. You started your research in the 90s. So they were still basically trying to withhold this type of information.
Exactly. No, absolutely. So they gave me the runaround for years.
Wow.
And one day I woke up and I decided, why don't I just walk into One Police Plaza? I'm from New York. And talk to these people. And I did precisely that. And they were like, oh, you're Professor Fernandez. Yes, we have your request right here. And we're going to respond to it as soon as possible. And you are going to be happy with the, you know, with our decision. This was in November that I decided. November, I can't remember what year. In December, they hadn't responded. I call them. And they were like, yeah, we're going to get to you. I get a letter in April that says that they're going to dismiss my request on the basis of a technicality.
Okay.
This is after years of back and forth letters. I mean, so many things were happening in my life. I was also involved in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the political prisoner.
Yes, I read about that as
well. I made a film about the case. I mean, I took time at Rook. I would have needed a research assistant, at least part-time, to keep track of the letters that I had to write and that they were writing to me, the NYPD. So I just got pissed off. And I borrowed money, hired a lawyer, and sued the NYPD.
Oh, wow.
And I was just pissed. I was just angry. And it turned out that I was the first person to sue the NYPD following a ruling in 1985 that asked the NYPD to deposit all of these surveillance files with the Municipal Archive of the City of New York, which they never did.
Mm.
This is the famous handshoe law.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So then the New York Times, everyone and their mother wanted to interview me. I was like, not ready for prime time. I just sued the bastards because they pissed me off and they were so disrespectful and duplicitous. So in the end, my suit led to the recovery of over 1 million surveillance records.
Wow.
Of the NYPD, by the NYPD of American, of New Yorkers, including those of Malcolm X.
Wow.
So it wasn't only the FBI. If you think about surveillance, surveillance is a local job.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI is a federal institution. They would have needed the support and the of the NYPD as foot soldiers in the surveillance, and that's exactly what you see.
Mm-hmm. And in Chicago as well, I would imagine. You were saying how they were always following Cha-Cha around. Speaking of the New York chapter, let me ask you a little bit about that. Did you interview some of the leaders of that? I know we have Pablo Guzman and others, and obviously it seems like their lives have taken a different turn. Yes, Chair Feliciano. It says that they have like different their lives have taken a different course, obviously, now. You don't really see them prominently in their activism anymore. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that and kind of how they had this rise, they had this impact, and then there was this decline? What did you find was behind that? Do you think it was effectiveness of this COINTELPRO program doing that? Was it a combination of that? And then just maybe, you know, as different generations come up, the drive isn't the same. Sometimes people are pacified by the changes that are there. You know, a gift can destroy the heart and the motivation of people. Do you have a view on that, or is anything in your research that's shown
Absolutely.
Anything on that?
Absolutely. So the first chapter of the book is on Chicago, and mm-hmm. Chacha Jimenez is my favorite young lord. I say that everywhere I go. The rest of the book is on the New York chapter of the Young Lords. So I interviewed all of or most of the Young Lords in New York, all of its leadership, Juan Gonzalez, Pablo Guzman, the chairman of the organization, Felipe Luciano, the person who was the founder of the organization, Mickey Melendez, the first woman to join the formal leadership body of the Young Lords, whose name is Denise Oliver. She's, by the way, Black American. I also interviewed Iris Morales. In New York, there was a rebellion on the part of the women who called out the men for not practicing what they preached revolutionarily with the women of the organization. So I interviewed many of them. And you asked what happened to the Young Lords. The Young Lords, like the Black Panthers, like the New Left, like so many other groups, are a product of a period. Mm-hmm. And a combination of forces led to the decline of these organizations and the activism of its members. Definitely, they were debilitated, devastated, and dismembered by COINTELPRO. Mm-hmm. Like COINTELPRO left the Young Lords last pair, for example.
Yeah.
In 1976, COINTELPRO was all over the Young Lords. But what else is happening is that the mass character of the movement subsides. There's an ebb and flow to social movements.
Yeah.
They're not forever. Think about Black Lives Matter. You have a window of opportunity within which to strike and win reforms. And if you don't capture that moment, it's over. But that doesn't mean that the movements and the people who led them are not important. Movements are not judged by the length of time they're around. They have to be judged by the kind of change they produced.
Right.
The young lords weren't around for long, but they accomplished a lot. So a combination of forces, COINTELPRO, the movement's broader decline, and the rise of conservatism in America in the 1970s and 80s, and incarceration replaced the dreams. There was a concerted effort on the part of the American government to redirect American society and assert its power. And it did that through the elimination of the social safety net, which it replaced with the building of prisons on a mass scale.
Yeah, and that's even its own topic by itself. We've also spoken about that. You know, I even had a professor when I'm a CUNY graduate myself, but in allied health. But, you know, I remember having a sociology professor in particular, and it was kind of astounding to me because I really on the first day of class, he was going into, and especially hostels being in the Bronx, very, very heavily minority, so to speak, in there. And he basically kind of said something similar today. He said, you know, this whole system and the way it's all set up, he's like, it's all against you guys, you know, and, you know, it's like that school to prison pipeline that they speak about. And his emphasis was to tell us, you know, to take important what we're very importantly and very seriously what we're embarking on in, you know, trying to get our higher education and to be impactful in that, like, you know, kind of letting us know the deck stacked against you. But you mentioned the prison thing. And again, I know that we can go through its own thing with that and how that's used.
Well, what's important to mention is that the Young Lords and the Black Panthers, they were writing about this and talking about this before academics started talking and writing about it.
Yeah.
They saw the writing on the wall and started, you know, writing about it in their newspaper and giving talks about it. And in fact, the Young Lords occupied a church for the second time in East Harlem in 1970 after one of their members was found hanged at the infamous jail in New York known as the Tombs.
Mm.
And they decided to occupy the church again in protest, but also in protest of the horrific conditions under which Black American and Puerto Rican prisoners were being held. And the growth, the exponential growth of imprisonment. Before the American state decided to mass incarcerate or hyper incarcerate people of color, they trained their guns and their prisons on American radicals. Right? If you think about the late 60s was one big campaign to free Huey, to free this one, and to free the other one. Because the American government had an interest in criminalizing the activism of people who were exposing American empire domestically and abroad.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, you kind of see shades of that coming to light again now. I wouldn't blame it on any one individual, but, you know, obviously you had the Trump years and him being so outspoken in regards to that kind of gave, I don't want to say gave rise, but kind of shed light on a lot of that attitude still being in the country. And I think that ignorantly, a lot of people would look at it and say, we're past that. But it seems like it's been made more evident that if anything, it's almost even worse. And again, because of the way at the speed at which information spreads and how easy it is for people to communicate and organize. And, you know, you see specials on a lot of these white supremacist groups rising and things like that. But it seems like the government is, I mean, on the surface, you see the face of it saying one thing. But obviously, you still see issues is my point. And I feel like, you know, in that regard, do you think like there's a place for movements like that. Like, you know, the Young Lords obviously had their decline, the Brown Berets. You know, you have the new Black Panther Party, but, you know, you don't really see much going on there, maybe different ideals and so on. Not the same type of convictions, perhaps.
Right.
What do you see now for, like, this generation as far as that activism? You know, like, how's the agenda changed with the times?
Well, every generation has to develop its own methods of struggle. And they can't be a replica of the revolutions and movements last time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the revolutions and movements last time were a product of conditions of that period.
Right.
I mentioned that after World War II, there was a period of wars and revolutions against European colonial rule.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to influence what organizations look like. When I mentioned that the Black Panthers established a model for others to follow, they were following the model of the liberated people of the Third World,
right,
and their army, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the structure, and I write about this in the book, like I outline what the structure of the organization was like. They had I can't remember now, but they had a chairman. They had the head of education and media and what did they call themselves again? Lord Jesus, I wrote an entire book about this and I can't remember now.
Well, it's a lot of information that you gathered. It took about 30 years almost. So
essentially, they had a central committee.
Yeah.
A central committee. That's something they grabbed from Cuba. Like, mm-hmm. The Panthers wore a beret.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
The Black Beret, they were much the Cuban barbudos, right? And wore Black Beret.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Black Panthers adapted that in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution.
Mm.
So organizations have to emerge today out of the conditions of this moment.
Mm.
And also consider that the Black Panthers and the Young Lords emerged after more than 15 years of struggle. It emerged in the mid-60s, in 1966, the Black Panthers, and the Young Lords in 1968 and 69, at the height of radicalization in the country and the world. So these were not organizations that were, you know, around in the 1950s, like the civil rights organizations that Martin Luther King helped build, or the young people of the South built the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1960. This is an organization that emerges in the North, and it understands that in the North, racism is much more structural, and it's tied to economic oppression. And that in order to change the condition of people of color in the North, there would have to emerge serious radical reforms, if not revolutions.
Hmm.
So, but that's a conclusion you draw after more than a decade of fighting for the same thing and getting nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, you know, I think my big takeaway in researching these groups, as we've done in different topics on the show, in speaking with you, there's definitely a template that can be followed. And there's some commonalities that show the foundation of what brings success to these organizations. And obviously, like you said, you got to find kind of your adjustment for the era, right? And obviously it was a different era back then. But these things, like the structure, the organization, the different programs that they had in place.
the commitment, it can be a part-time thing.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that with the commitment. It makes me think of Dr. Sanchez from the Brown Berets. He said they used to call them committed butts, people who were, like, really about it. He said,
really, but you got to be about it 25 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
Yeah, and that's powerful. I'm glad that you said that. It's not a part-time thing. Like you have to live and breathe it. And I think that's one of the things that impresses me so much about those that came before us. And like you said, though there were different things that led to their decline, I don't think it could ever be taken for granted.
Right.
Because, you know, they say hindsight's 20/20, so it's easy to pick apart things after the fact. But you can't take for granted what they accomplished, how they did it. And I think that's another critical one. I love when I find those common threads in these interviews that we've done and in these shows that we brought out, and that commitment level. So you said you got to be about it 25/7. That means no. Even when you're sleeping, you're on it.
Absolutely.
On it, and you're doing that out. Let me ask you this: what are some things you think people can do in these times to engage more with their communities and bring more light to the issues our people still deal with in these times?
I think the most important thing is to not stand as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You got to join an organization and you have to build something. You can't go against the system solo. And it's not about you. It's about collective action toward the transformation of society. And it's about developing a strategy, right? That's what these organizations were about. They had a strategy. They had a theory of revolution.
Yeah.
And debated. So I think the most important thing is to find out who you want to hang with, who thinks the way you do, and build with those people. The system is designed to make us cynical and to encourage us to give up.
Mm.
Wow. We're more likely to give up if we take, you know, this on individually as an ego thing.
Right.
This is a long-term struggle, and we want to pass the baton on to a different generation. And we might not see drastic change in our lifetime, but wherever there is inequality, eventually there is uprising.
That's right. That's right. It's almost as a necessary, it's a necessary thing. Like that opposition rises against it. So,
definitely. Yeah.
You have something you wanted to say, Ashaya? You have something on your face. I know you had some questions.
I did have
some
questions.
I'm here talking and asking all the questions. You had some questions for the doctor. And let me just take a moment to cue this up in case people do want to call in. The call-in number is 516-531-9797. 516-531-9797. If you have questions for us or for Dr. Fernandez, by all means, you can call in, ask your questions, and, you know, let's take advantage of this opportunity that we have to gather this type of information.
Yes.
What do you have, Ashaya?
I am so mind blown right now. This is awesome. This is exactly what we do on this radio show. We interview people who about this, right? So you said that you, Chacha Jimenez, is your favorite young lord. Was there anything that stood out that he said that you every day that you think of that is just something that significant? Thank you.
For so many things. So many things. I remember the story he told me about integrating the beach with his guys while they were in the gang. Their parents were new migrants to Chicago, both Mexican and Puerto Rican, and they were mild-mannered and, you know, put their heads down and worked and were exploited. But this new generation of young people, of which Chacha was a part, they were not going to bow down to to the white supremacy of white workers in Chicago. And there was a new confidence that they deployed. And one day, Cha-Cha tells me, and this is in the book, Cha-Cha says to me, so, you know, we want to go to the beach, but the beach is segregated in Chicago. And for us to go to the beach, we have to go to Carajo Land to go to the beach. But we don't want to go to Carajo Land. We want to go right here, right at the corner. So we decide we're going to go to the beach right now. And they go and they battle it out with the white gangs. And they win. And they desegregate. And after that battle, their parents were able to go to the beach.
The things we take for granted.
Yeah, you would look at that as, you know, some people might look at it and say, oh, so that, what's the big deal? They took over beach. But I think just the effort and the result after the fact, I mean, all those little things.
It's also about dignity.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also about dignity, like not having to go halfway around the world to enjoy access to the city.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To like, yeah.
And it's about not being pushed around.
Right. Wow. Hey, I know some of the audience is saying that, I know the sister, well, I don't know if that's a, I'm assuming that's, there's people who have questions here. You can also type your questions into the chat and we'll relate them to Dr. Fernandez if you have them, if you can't call, all right? I think a brother there said he had some questions too. So you can type them in, we can read those off as well. You know, I also wanted to mention, I did read in some of my research about there was an emphasis as well for the young lords about the Puerto Rican independence. What association or affinity, if any, was there for Pedro Albizu Campos and kind of what he went through and what he did? We spent a large segment of shows. I don't know if you're familiar with the book War Against All Puerto Ricans.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we went through a lot of that portion of that book here on the show and speaking about that and some of the tactics and things that, and again, seeing
the
organization, yep. The passion, the conviction, and seeing the same way the government tried to derail that and discredit and demonize. You know, the man spent so many years unjustly in prison. I mean, there's photos in the book of
they started,
some of the experiments they ran on him, yep. And things that they did to him. What did you find in your research, like in regards to that type of information? How was that an inspiration for them as well?
So in the interview with Cha-Cha Jimenez that was published in the Black Panther Party newspaper on June 7th, 1969, one of the questions the Black Panthers ask is about Puerto Rico and what's his position on Puerto Rico. And Cha-Cha Jimenez says that we need to free Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, and we stand with Puerto Rican independence. And Don Pedro Albizu Campos, who's the father of Puerto Rican nationalism, was someone they read and respected, both in Chicago and in New York. So they were revolutionary nationalists. They believed in the independence of Puerto Rico as one of their major goals. And they also believed in uniting people from Latin America who migrated to the United States. And they were the first group to use the term Latin or Latino to refer to people who land in the United States on the after the United States has either invaded a country in Latin America or helped displace farmers through U.S. economic policy in the region.
We went through a lot of that as well with the Monroe Doctrine and, you know, the Banana Wars and the School of the Americas and all the influence that was done in all those regions. And it's to us, it's not insignificant, any of that. All those things we look to as examples as well, because like you said, with critical race theory and them trying to kind of hide them facing basically what the country was built on. You know, earlier you mentioned the whole capitalism piece and It absolutely is what kind of drove all this. You know, you talk about Manifest Destiny and their desire for them to, you know, go into the West, so to speak, starting with the indigenous, the Holocaust of all the indigenous people here in the land grab and the resource grab. And then when, you know, they came to colonize from Europe and, you know, the free slave labor that allowed them to build this country. And I mean, it's just such a vicious cycle of this that my point being, Latin America today still suffers from many of the, I mean, look at Cuba to this day with the blockade.
Right.
I mean, we did a whole segment on that. We had the blessing of being able to go to Cuba and, you know, kind of reach out to the people there and, you know, kind of do some ministry there and whatnot. And we saw firsthand kind of how it is there and what's going on. And I mean, I'm talking about maybe, what was that, like 4 years ago we went?
2018.
Yeah. And it was really profound for many of us to see that. But it's like these issues are still there and the impact of them are still there today. So, you know, starting with that Monroe Doctrine of America being the police of this hemisphere and, you know,
right.
just kind of poking their nose and deposing people and proxy wars and all these other things. I mean, there's just so much interconnectivity. I don't want to sound like I'm going off on a rant, but then it also makes me think of Juan Gonzalez and Harvest of Empire. And we went
exactly.
over that documentary on the show and
right.
what drives the immigration here and people thinking it's that, oh, everybody just wants to come here because it's so great. Well, no, you've destabilized our country so badly
right.
that, you know, we have no choice but to come somewhere else
right.
because of the lasting effects of these things. And it's,
and so that's really important because there's a lot of debate about, you know, what is it that defines Latinos? And part of what the Young Lords argued is that what unites Latinos is U.S. foreign policy and economic policy in Latin America, which displaces people who are forced to migrate to the United States.
That's right.
Those migrants are Latinos.
That's right. And then there's that demonization, right, where they're criminals, they're rapists coming
right.
here and so on that they'll say. And well, when Trump said, why can't we get people from good countries and not, part of my language, not shithole countries, right? So, you know, it's like it's alive and well today. Do you have any more questions for the doctor?
Yes, I had one, and it was going towards Puerto Rico. Is what is your input on Puerto Rico today? And it's a lot of cheap real estate. Well, I don't know if it still is, but it was a lot of cheap real estate and a lot of tax breaks. A lot of Americans going out there, moving to Puerto Rico, and pretty much again taking the land from the people.
Right, and that's an extension of the colonial project that the United States launched in Puerto Rico in 1898.
That's right.
You know, that wasn't a cakewalk. That came with mass land displacement and mass exports to American businesses to set up shop on that island, which became the pharmaceutical capital of the world in the second half of in the first half of the 20th century, where the pill, the birth control pill, was tested on Puerto Rican women. And a third of the women of the island were sterilized as a result of these experiments. So, Puerto Rico is one of the new frontiers of capitalism and capitalist investment since Hurricane Katrina. Not Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Maria, excuse
That's
me.
That's right, yes.
And, yeah, Americans are moving over there and buying property. And Puerto Rican youth are leaving Puerto Rico because it's hard to survive there. So I think there are 6 million Puerto Ricans in the diaspora now here who live here. In the United States, and that number jumped exponentially after Hurricane Maria. So Puerto Ricans are being driven out by PROMESA. You probably know that the island is $70 billion in debt.
Yep.
And it can't file for bankruptcy.
Nope.
Because it's a colony of the United States that's not allowed to file for bankruptcy, much like Haiti still owes France, you know, money for having freed itself from the colonists.
Right. Right. And, you know, they say this, they call it a commonwealth to try to make it sound like such a nice word.
Yep.
And I think someone was, I was reading something where they said Puerto Rico pretty soon is not going to have any Puerto Ricans in it.
Right.
Like, they're just,
they're gone.
It's like a land grab. It's a tax benefit grab.
Yep.
They're kind of like what they did with some of the South Bronx and kind of building it up and, you know, fixing up the buildings and then, you know, market it to, I know before I left, they were calling it like Sobro. And building up a lot of those areas.
Right.
And, you know, our people weren't going to be able to afford those things, you
right.
know. I remember even in El Barrio, Spanish Harlem, before I left, they were trying to fight, like, this high-rise building that nobody there was going to be able to afford.
Wow.
So you know what starts
right.
to – you know, they say if you see a Starbucks in the neighborhood,
there it goes,
the gentrification is happening. There goes the
right.
neighborhood. They're starting to change the dynamic of it. And it's like they're doing it to a whole country in Puerto Rico.
Yes.
Exactly. It's on a mass scale. It's just gentrification on a mass scale.
Yeah.
With tax breaks. And, you know, there was a convention in Puerto Rico in the last year or two that brought American businessmen to the island to talk about the opportunities.
Gosh. Wow.
To take American dollars to the island to make them work, but also as a tax haven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the big thing that we're seeing, like the tax haven for a lot to draw a lot of these investors there to basically, you know, again, just kind of gentrify the whole island, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, what's your take on, I mean, because you see a lot of this still going on. Do you think there's major radical changes that can be done anymore in this current environment?
Well...
And I know it's hard. I don't want you to sound pessimistic in the answer, but it just seems so daunting. Like, where's the change going to come from?
Well, in 2019, there was a massive uprising, the largest uprising in the history of Puerto Rico, that displaced the governor, José Yo.
Yes, yes.
I mean, those protests were epic. That hadn't been seen before. And the independence flag, with the light blue, the baby blue flag, was everywhere. That was a completely new development in the history of Puerto Rico. So the question is, how do we move from these episodic uprisings to something more sustained?
Hmm.
And that's going to take a combination of forces, objective conditions plus the subjective interventions of organizations and leaders in the world to transform society, both in Puerto Rico and the United States and beyond. It's a combination of things. It's conditions,
mm-hmm.
but it's also the decisive actions of people to be about change 25/7.
Right, that 25/7, that commitment. Right? Exactly, it's that 25/7. I like that term. I'm going to use 20 instead of 24/7. I'm going to use 25/7.
Right, 25. Well, that's directly from the Young Lords.
Oh wow, look at that.
In the Black Panther.
Even more. I'm going to use it now. That's incredible. Hey, producers, did we get any callers? Is everybody being shy? No? Can you guys talk to me in the booth?
You hear me, sir?
Yes.
Okay, I'll praise. We got one call, but she just wanted to let us know that she posted her question in the comments. So
oh.
Let her know that we're going to make our way to the comments.
What was the question in the comments? Did you happen to catch it so we can ask it?
She didn't tell us specifically what her question was.
Oh, gosh.
Kind of rambled a little
okay.
bit.
Okay. All right. It is what it is.
Well, tell your listeners to go out and buy the book.
Oh, I was going to tell you. Many were commenting that they want to buy the book. So, absolutely. And like I said, I have it. I'm going to start reading it. I have some opportunity coming up where I can get into it a little bit. I bought it as a Kindle version on purpose so I can read it on the go.
Right.
I do prefer pages in a book, but just the way my schedule is, having it in the phone would make it a little more conducive to go through it. I am very excited to go. I know it's like 400 plus pages, so I know there's a big book. Yeah, it's a big book.
It's a long book, but it's written in a very engaging manner.
Oh, I can imagine. It was a very engaging interview. I mean, you know, I always get a little nervous with interviews because I'm not sure how much the guests are going to speak when you ask these questions. Mm-hmm. And from the outset, it was fantastic. I can tell from your intro that we were going to have a good interview here.
Yes.
Well, listen, tell your listening audience to buy the darn book. it's in a soft cover now. It just came out in soft cover.
Awesome.
But mostly, I want you to get the book so that you can read it.
Yeah.
Because I am the human being I am today because I wrote this history and I learned about it.
Yeah.
It will change your life. The reason why I've been able to spend so many years thinking and writing and researching the Young Lords is because the history is incredible.
Mm. Yes,
it's not believable.
Wow.
If I hadn't actually found the documents to prove what the Young Lords were telling me in their interviews. So, for example, the Young Lords went to a military site here in New Jersey. They went to Fort Dix because a soldier wrote to them and asked the Young Lords to be present at his court-martial.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And at the court-martial, the Young Lords fought the military police.
Wow.
And I was like, so Richie Perez, a Young Lord who's deceased now, told me the story. He's the only one who told me the story. I asked the other Young Lords, they were like, oh, yeah, that happened. But as a historian, you can't take Richie Perez's, you know, story at face value. So I had to find evidence of that, and I found it at the Tamiman Library at NYU, which is the labor library. They had all of the newspapers that were published by soldiers who were engaged in rebellion during the Vietnam War. And sure enough, the story was there. Amazing stories like those abound in the book. It's a history of courage and defiance and great dreams for a different world. And it's a way to see ourselves in the history of this country.
Mm.
Another thing that's important is that this was not a history of white Latinos. This was a history of Black Latinos and Latinos of color becoming leaders in their communities.
Right.
It was the first time that this happened. And of course, it happened in part because Puerto Ricans migrated into the civil rights movement.
Right.
They migrated into the civil rights and Black Power movement, and a section of the Puerto Rican community was influenced by the politics of Black Power. And they also lived together in these neighborhoods with Black Americans.
Right, right.
And so as you were saying earlier, that in New York, you know, Puerto Ricans and Black Americans, we all live in the same neighborhoods and in the same projects. Well, something like 25 to 30% of the membership of the Young Lords was composed of Black Americans.
Wow.
Because people lived in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah. I tell people out here all the time, I was like, it's different because, you know, you have that Black-Mexican divide on the West Coast, and mm-hmm. there's obviously some animosity there. And I don't know what that is because it wasn't like that for me growing up in the Bronx. Like,
right.
But you know what? There's a similar story with the Black Panthers. There were a lot of Latinos in the Black Panther Party, but that history hasn't been told.
No. And I firmly believe that's by design because there's that whole, you know, it's one thing to have all Black America unite, but now you're taking, you know, the so-called Latino and even the indigenous, you know, you had the AIM movement which we didn't get too much into as well. I mean, and even though Latinos to me are indigenous as well, I think a lot of times mm-hmm. that goes kind of unaddressed. You know, we say indigenous and we only think, you know, so-called Native Americans. But I mean, you know, this side of the world, I mean, we were indigenous to this. So I think that's profound. There's one question here, and I would like the answer to it, because you did say how Cha-Cha was your favorite. You said mm-hmm. there was a lot of great interaction with him. But someone in the audience asked, why was he your favorite? What was it in particular that made him your favorite to interview and engage with?
Okay, so you have to read chapter one.
Okay.
He's my favorite. So when you read the book, please email me about it.
Okay.
But Cha-Cha has a beautiful sense of humor. Mm-hmm. He's self-effacing. He has a lot of passion. But he's understated. So he's a leader who doesn't have a lot of ego. And he's always making fun of himself. And he's endearing. I mean, he's just such an honest human being who ultimately wants to be a better human being. And he wants his people to do better. It's just beautiful. Another thing is, and this is the argument I made at the end of chapter one, which is that Cha-Cha Jimenez and the Young Lords are remembered today because they made common cause with the most demeaned and the most persecuted organization in the United States, the Black Panther Party.
Yeah.
The folks that immigrants or migrants don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. But because the Young Lords was a gang, they didn't have an iota of middle class respectability in them. And it was automatic that they were going to make common cause with the Black Panthers. No argument.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the case in New York. In New York, a group of Puerto Rican students had been meeting. They were looking for an organizing agenda. They were reading the newspaper of the Black Panther Party, but they never thought, oh, well, why don't we just become the Puerto Rican counterpart of the Black Panther Party? No, it took a gang to make that leap. Because we all know that when migrants come to the United States, the first thing we learn is to distance ourselves from Black Americans.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I talk about that a lot with my mom growing up. And, you
of
know,
course.
I'll say it bold-faced. I mean, obviously, I'm on the lighter persuasion of a Puerto Rican. And, you know, my mom was like, you know, yeah, you'd be friends with them and whatnot. I mean, that, like, it was there growing up in the 80s. You know, you could be friends with them, meaning Black people. She was like, you know, just don't marry one and don't. That's like, you know, where does this come from? And we've gone over that in this show. That's something that's ingrained.
Internalized racism.
Yeah, yeah. And it's there. And, you know, I mean, I'm thankful I never let that set in me. But it's like, you know, where does that come from? And, gosh, it's just so part of the machine, the socialization that happens when you come here, and that's part of it, you know, like they push that on a lot of people, and there's some people.
Well, migrants and immigrants, they have to deal with a lot.
Yeah.
They're outsiders in this country. They're foreigners. Even Puerto Ricans who are citizens are perceived as foreigners.
Oh yeah.
We don't speak the language, and you're already stigmatized, and you don't need more stigma.
No.
So it's understandable why migrants and immigrants would do that, but it also has a lot to do with white supremacy as it developed in Latin America.
Yeah.
And the Young Lords theorized how racism develops in Latin America, different and distinct from how it develops in North America under British rule. Under Spanish rule, the logic is that a drop of white blood will bring you closer to the white ideal. Mm-hmm. In the United States, a drop of black blood makes you black.
Yeah.
So two completely different ways of being racist that are accompanied with distinct ideologies that our parents adapt, right?
Yeah.
And adopt.
Yeah. And, you know, Juan Gonzalez wrote about that heavily when he discusses Dominicans and largely the Cubans.
Yes.
And how you had one migration that was, you know, of the lighter persuasion.
Yep.
That were treated differently when they got here.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the descendants of them today as that Florida base of Cubans that will support kind of the, you know, Republicans. And then they talk about how, you know, once things changed and it didn't benefit them as far as, you know, the communist agenda, the darker ones started coming and they were treated, you know, in a different respect. And so
you have two
sides there. And same things with Dominicans. They were talking about that when Dominicans came here, how it was like set up in their minds for Puerto Ricans to be against them based on that.
Right.
As well. And so that dynamic is, that's, again, something else, even within ourselves in the communities, a lot of walls to break down in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
To get that kind of level of unification again. And again, it's a testament to these groups and how they were able to come together in the face of that and be able to unify, you know, for a common goal. You know, someone posted another question, Doctor, and we have been trying to reach out. We're just not sure where to. They asked if we can get Cha-Cha on the show.
Oh my God. You know what? Cha-Cha is not well.
I know he's up there in age.
I wanted to ask you, is he, I know he was, some people were saying he was deceased. Some people were saying he's very sick. So,
He's sick,
okay,
but
good.
He's not deceased.
Okay.
He's not making any public presentations.
Yeah,
right.
He hasn't for like a couple of years.
Yeah. It's been hard for us to try to reach out.
We try to reach out.
That's sad to hear. Well, we're going to try to explore him via your book.
Yes.
Okay. As we dive into it.
Any of the other young lords that we can possibly interview that you might think that we can get on the show?
Oh, absolutely. You should have a woman of the young lords talk to your audience. Denise Oliver, Mickey Melendez.
Mm.
Write it down. Yeah. Mickey Melendez. I'm sure Felipe Luciano would be happy to come on.
Oh, that'd be great.
No, absolutely. Yeah. They're open. Totally.
I got two things. So number one, any sneak peek of any future projects that you might be working on? I know you're very heavily into Mumia Abu Jamal, and I was looking into that a lot, and it's very interesting. And I did see your interview with that. I don't care what her name is, that white lady on the news.
Oh my God, that woman on Fox. Yeah.
Yes. But any other projects that you are working on, any future big projects like this one you had?
Well, I'm in the process of identifying my new project, but I think I'm going to try to make heads or tails of those Handshoe files, the 1 million surveillance records of New Yorkers compiled by the NYPD between 1954 and 1971 or 72. So that's my new project, figuring out the relationship between that and American democracy. This is mass surveillance, like mass surveillance that depends on citizens to surveil on each other. Like in many ways, I just wrote an article titled, The Historical Roots of American Fascism. And one of the tenets of fascism is that you have to recruit the population to go after the known enemy. If you don't have that, you don't have fascism.
Wow.
And the United States has pretty much perfected that. Getting Americans to surveil and go after other Americans.
Mm.
So yeah, I think I want to explore like the meaning of that for the rise of fascism in the form of Trump, right?
Yeah.
I think that in many ways, Trump's rise to power was a consolidation of the counter-revolution against the 60s.
Mm.
That's how that gets consolidated.
Wow.
The counter-revolution after the 60s that wants to eliminate everything that the 60s produced.
Yeah.
And that is tied up in a bun with the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah. I often say I like Trump from the perspective of he said what a lot of white America was thinking and were too afraid to say.
Yeah. Right.
And I think he emboldened more of those people to come out. And for me, that creates an awareness for our people to kind of, you know, wake up from the slumber of the illusion of inclusion and mm-hmm. kind of see that there's still a lot more work to be done.
Right.
You know, so
absolutely.
We're coming up on the end of our show, Doctor. This was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I really want to thank you for your passion. I can tell this is a very important topic to you. I mean, you said it even in yourself. It kind of transformed your way you saw things. You weren't aware of it. I mean, I think there's so much more we could potentially say, but we will certainly, most certainly keep in touch with you. I'd like to read the article that you have. So maybe a shy, I don't know if you have a link to
I'll definitely send it to you. It's short. It's not as long as the book. It's short.
No, please do. Please do. And, no, I'm going to dive into the book. It's been a busy several months for me right now, but like I said, I have some time coming up and I'd like to use these different books as a reference for the show. Like I said, we did Juan Gonzalez's book and documentary Harvest of Empire. We did War Against All Puerto Ricans.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to kind of diving into your book, because again, there's not a lot written out there about the young Lord. So to have such an expansive work done on it, I'm very much looking forward to it and using it for our audience and to kind of bring that out and bring it forth as well.
I'm going to hold you to it.
Oh, then great. And maybe we can have a follow up and you know,
exactly.
speak a little more in detail in regards to the book. So I'm very much looking forward to reading it and applying it for our audience. And we have a lot of people. Can we put the book up for the audience? Put the picture up again of the book and the title so they can go look. Some people said they're going to go buy it after the show. All right, yeah, scroll so they can see.
Let's go down.
So that's it on the right. All right, this is Dr. Fernandez on the left. The book is on the right. All right, The Young Lords, A Radical History. All right, I love that picture. I love that picture.
Yeah, that photograph of The Young Lords is
brilliant. I love it. It's just it reminds me, you know, of me growing up in the Bronx. I mean, in the 80s, it was still relatively like that. And, you know, you might not have seen the same level of activism, but it brings back and evokes memories of that time. But thank you again so much. We really, truly value it. A lot of people have been posting how it's been a very positive experience for them. And we're always seeking to kind of bring out, we say, kind of a hidden history that's not there.
Yep.
And this certainly fulfilled kind of the aim of our show that we do weekly here. Yes. So thank you again, Doctor. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation and for the engaging conversation.
I appreciate it. And we'll be in touch and hopefully we can do a follow-up down the line.
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care. You have a good evening. I know it's late on the East Coast there, so thank you again.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
All right, guys, did you disconnect? We'll do our close out here. Wow, that was, I think that was great.
It was.
Hey, the Dr. Sanchez one was great. I think these interviews are fantastic. They're a little slow to come by.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to reach these people and get in touch, but all praises to the Most High for the team that's looking for us always to bring things forth. We've been wanting to get somebody that can speak intelligently to the young lords for a long time. Mm. We've been trying to get some of the young lords themselves.
We've been trying to get Chacha Jimenez. I actually called because there was a website and with his number and I think maybe his assistant. And I called and I asked, is this for, can I get in contact with Chacha Jimenez? Not directly, but I said, we would like to interview him for our radio show, our podcast. This was maybe
10 months ago?
Yeah.
This is a while.
Well, now we know why. She said for the past couple of years he hasn't really been making appearances and whatnot. So, but hey, maybe we have some connections now to get some of these other young lords, the New York-based ones, to maybe get on the show. I think that would also be edifying to speak with some people who are kind of boots on the ground and dealing with that. So
25/7.
And I believe the niece Oliver was the sister that she said was was Judah.
Basically. She's that right there on that picture.
Yeah.
She's that one right there on holding the radio. That's the niece Oliver.
Yeah. So.
And then that's Gonzalez. What's her name? On the left hand side with
Juan Gonzalez.
Yep.
On
the left hand side.
Yeah. That's Juan Gonzalez.
That's Juan Gonzalez right there. Yep.
Yeah. He looks the same.
Yeah.
He haven't really aged much. Looks the same.
No. Above the one with
right
the
there, with
beret.
With the beret. Yep.
On the left hand side.
He's on he's on that news show that a lot. That
Democracy
Now. Yeah. He features a lot on that show with the Edomite woman.
Mm-hmm.
And he features a lot talking about. We've used segments from that on the show to discuss certain things. So, we pray that the show was edifying. We'll probably have some follow up commentary as a recap when we do our next show. Next week, Lord's will. So we might spend a little portion just kind of going in. There was a lot of opportunity for biblical references, but I didn't want to interrupt her flow and what we were bringing out. I took some notes. I know all of you had some thoughts. Keep those, and we could spend some time next week. See, I'm going to say we're going to do two topics, but we're not. Watch us just talk about this the whole next show.
Right. We have to, Kev. I don't know. Like, look, I'm like so overwhelmed with like the history because. It's crazy, bro. Like, imagine them wanting to go to what she was talking about, the beach. I don't know, Cap.
Yeah.
I'm just
overwhelmed. You know, listen, I think maybe to some of those that are newer in this walk, will see something like that and say, well, that's insignificant. So what? They got to get on the beach.
Right.
You have to understand the motivation, the desire that drives that type of behavior. You know what stood out to me when she says these guys went and showed up to this guy's court martial, this brother's court martial, and fought the misery. Because you got a lot of brothers and sisters that are afraid to go to certain areas to preach, that are afraid to go and kind of bring this information out to people in certain areas. And I've said this before. We always say what really was lacking in the decline of a lot of these groups is that they didn't have the Bible as their foundation.
Exactly.
One thing we didn't speak about, and we'll talk about next week, Lord's will, when we do our commentary for the show, there has to be a behavior change and a sustained one. Mm-hmm. And that's where the Bible and the law, statutes, and commandments come into play for our people. Because in order to facilitate a world without end, like the Bible speaks about in relation to the Israelites, which are the blacks, Hispanics, Native American.
That's right.
There has to be a sustained change. I was thinking of the Willie Lynch where it said, unless there's a phenomenon that occurs that prevents that thing, that white supremacy from spinning on its axis. And it's all these revolutionaries and these, and in the case of Dr. Fernandez, as a historian to bring this stuff to light, they all say the same thing. Mm-hmm. And yet you got brothers and sisters in here that they don't realize that you're actually puppets for the so-called white man.
Right. I was getting cut.
In what you regurgitate and in what you say. You know, remember I said I'd like to build to a class that's been in my spirit to do for a while about casual believers. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about it the other day about the levels of believers and how everybody's not in the same situation in here. And very few are going to be that 25/7 type of person, like she said. Wow. Very few are going to do that. And, you know, Bishop said it at men's conference. There's a war.
Right.
We're at war. And what's amazing about this is that we have a leader that they can't touch. They can't discredit.
Mm.
And that's Christ.
That's right.
And that example. So this is where there's staying power in this. But it's not to say there's not something to take from the template of what these groups did, which we see that in IUIC and we see that in the Bible and what we're bringing forth. So, again, a lot, I think, for us to kind of dialogue about next week. We're going to have both of them on again.
Yeah,
we should have both of them because they were here. All right.
Yeah,
I know you guys are supposed to alternate, but we'll have both of you on so that we can go through it and speak your thoughts. So write your notes, speak your thoughts.
Yes, sir.
All right. So that we can have an open discussion about this. And those of you who tuned in today, we'd love to have you call in and comment for next week. We'll do it more as a little kind of open dialogue. About the interview that we did
Bishop
today.
Bishop Yawasop was on. Most High Christ bless you,
But Most High Christ bless you, Bishop Yawasop. I know he's always supporting the show. We very much appreciate it. I can't wait to kind of pick his brain a little bit. I know after we did the David Sanchez one, I spoke to him a little bit about it. So, but all praises to the Most High. I like opening those doors. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a connection with her now, and yeah. I believe she enjoyed the podcast. You know, I mean, she said it was an engaging dialogue. So I think so as well. Very interesting. The body of work that she's done.
Yes.
I am going to start reading the book because no, I want to use it in the show. I'd love to break it down more. We're not done with the Young Lords. I got to represent for Ephraim.
That's right.
So-called Puerto Ricans. I got to represent for Ephraim.
Right. Hey,
we're going to bring it out.
If you were here on Sunday, you would have seen how I was dressed. I'm ready to go preach in Puerto Rico.
So de la tribu de Efraín. Dale luz, primo.
He ready.
Nah, man, because, you know, listen, I know Northern Kingdom's a silly dove, man, but not all. Yeah, there were spirits there that had that spirit in them.
Yep,
and what that
people.
Tells you is that there's more. There's more here now. There's more here ready to come in. There's more ready to be developed. That 11th hour to be able to continue to unify the 12 tribes, to unify our people.
Yes, sir.
And have that sustained behavior change that's going to bring about that phenomenon.
Right? There's a foundation started for them.
Hey,
someone
says, spoiler alert, we win at the end. You right about that?
Right.
That's right.
You right about that? That's right.
Brothers are asleep. Come on, brothers.
We do is I know no sound effects, nothing. Maybe they were in awe from the interview too. I don't know. Hey, Southern Kingdom, I pray y'all took notes. All right, for all you haters who say Northern Kingdom ain't Israel, you got some dose of medicine today. You know
that's right.
And many of you ain't gonna listen anyway because of your hateful selves perpetrating that white supremacy. All right, but yeah, you heard it, Black Panthers. We're in the Brown Berets. They were in the Young Lords.
Yes.
All right. Judah and Ephraim were working together.
Bring it out.
All right. And I noticed she said how the Black Panthers were that template for these groups because their hands were in the neck of the oppressor, like you read about. All right. In Genesis. So let me tell you, it was heavy. It was powerful. We're going to talk about it more next week. Lord's Will Life Last Saturday, Spanish.
No, English.
English.
Yes, sir.
Check out the Power Hour on Facebook at the Lost 144K, Saturday at 11 Arizona time.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We got the English show 1 hour. They'll be going over that. Many of us will be in Tijuana this weekend. All right. We're going to bring the word out to the
Tribe of
Issachar and Levi in Tijuana. All right. So Lord's will be out there. Send up prayers for us. Send up prayers for us for the Tijuana Blitz, all right?
That's right.
And then, Lord's will, next Wednesday you'll catch us. I believe the time change happens, so it'll be a little later on the East Coast and Central. It'll still be 7 p.m. Arizona time, but it'll be 10 p.m. Eastern.
Right.
Sometimes we have a drop-off in the audience due to that time change, but Lord's will, we don't. Tune in so we can discuss this incredible interview we had, all right?
Wow.
So with that, we say shalom.
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 Wow,
bro. That was heavy.
It was heavy, bro. It was straight spitting scripture, bro, like the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
Don't even know.
Time, bro, yeah.
And I was like, I ain't interrupting her flow.
Right.
We back.
Israel is back.
Yeah, because Israel is back, all lies on us, cause we keeping them laws. When the Lord returns, Babylon will fall. Precepts
solid.
We got them on lock.
God's
chosen people, with Christ as our rock. Israel is back.
We back.
Israel is back.
We back.
You heathen, get ready for our whip to crack.
Damn.